I'm Bill Barole. Over the last few decades, I've done every kind of writing there is to do, from journalism to humor, books, movies, and television.
I'm Matt Ricardo. For the last 30 years, I've toured the world as a variety performer.
We've come together across the Atlantic to talk about creativity, what it is, where it comes from, why it matters.
Thomas Edison said, "To invent, you need a good imagination and a pile of junk."
This is Imagination and Junk, a conversation about the hard work of creativity.
Episode 23, Bread and Jean.
Dear Matt, let's class up the joint a little, shall we? Here's a story I love about Henri Matisse. It may well be apocryphal, but sometimes the best stories are. Here it is. Late in Matisse's life, a guy showed up at his studio and asked the artist to make him one of the paper collages he was famous for. Matisse agreed. He took a piece of paper and a scissors and made a few quick cuts, then arranged the pieces on a backing. "Magnifique," the visitor cried. "Brilliant! What do I owe you?" 10 million francs, Matisse replied. The visitor was stunned. "But that only took you 10 seconds, he said. "Wrong," Matisse said. "That took me 50 years. So, let's talk this week about the cliche that the great ones make it look easy. Let's talk about what is and isn't easy, and about experience and command of your tools, and how they can combine in something that simulates effortlessness, but is, in fact, just the opposite. One of my touchstones in this series has been a guy I worked with at Newsweek, Jerry Adler. Jerry was the premier back-of-the-book writer at the magazine during my time there, back-of-the-book being the catch-all term for the sections that weren't hard news, that were generally held to be the softer stuff. Jerry was known for a light touch. He could ease you into a story better than anybody else at the magazine. His stuff was a pleasure to read when it hit the newsstands on Monday morning. Here's what readers didn't see. The hours Jerry had spent on the preceding Friday night, closing night, padding up and down the long halls of 444 Madison Avenue in his stocking feet, deep in thought, bouncing a rubber band ball. You'd hear the thunk of the ball on the carpeted floor coming your way, then receding. Then returning. Then receding. He'd be staring somewhere ahead of him. Not here, not there. It was understood. You left Jerry alone when you saw him coming because he was hard at work. There's a famous quote about writing, variously attributed to Ernest Hemingway and Red Smith. "Writing is easy. You just sit at a typewriter, open up a vein, and bleed." Jerry Adler would bleed for his copy. But the copy would be as light as air. How does that happen? How does that alchemy occur? Here's my theory. The final refinement of a creator's technique is to plane away everything in the result that reveals any technique at all. This isn't easy, and it isn't something that just anybody can do. You can't do it until you know enough to recognize those places, those joins and seams, when you see them. That's where command of your tools comes in, and experience. You want to write a sentence as clean as a bone, James Baldwin said. That is the goal. But to the degree that cleanliness reads as easy, it's an illusion. It's a trick. There's a word comedy writers use to describe a line or a bit that shows the effort behind it. They call it sweaty. It's one of the harshest criticisms somebody in that business can offer. Never, as the saying goes, let them see you sweat. If you can, if your experience allows for it, make it look easy, right? But wait, hang on a second. I've seen your act, and I can attest that you do not make it look easy. You've talked about this in previous episodes. You want your audiences to appreciate that you're doing something hard, something that took years to master. You want to get them on your side. So here's my question. Is it always better to make it look easy Or do the great ones sometimes, well, if not make it look hard, do they decline to obscure how hard it is? And as a performer, how do you strike that balance? I'll talk to you next time. Bill.
Dear Bill, I like to show effort. Maybe because my dad always said I was lazy. Maybe because I want to make sure that my audience know that what they see as fun is also work. But mostly, I think, because I'm interested in telling them a story. I may have mentioned this before, but the legendary British magician Paul Daniels once said to me that a magic show is a play about someone who can do anything. I love that. It's a reminder that what we do is theatre, and however close the person we portray on stage is to the real us, it's not the real us, it's a character. But if a magic show is a play about someone who can do anything, then what is what I do? What I do, of course, isn't magic. It is, for want of a more accurate label, circus and comedy, so there's a different vibe going on there. The way I like to play it is not that it's a play about someone who can do anything, but rather a play about someone who wants to do something incredible. And the key phrase to the story I'm telling is wants to. Now, of course, in real life, I've worked pretty hard to make sure that all the feats of dexterity I've learned to do work first time, every time. But the story I tell the audience is that I want to impress them. I want to get the roar of a reaction when I manage to pull off something unexpected and impressive, and that roar is made bigger, and the audience feels they've seen something more special if the narrative surrounding the tricks is that I'm trying my best, that it's hard, but I want to try hard for them. Then, when it works, it means more than if I'd just done it casually, as if it's no challenge whatsoever. Now, this is just the way I like to present my work, and I guess it's all part of the clown mantra of making things more difficult for yourself, so you take the audience on a journey with you that ends in some kind of triumph over the odds. I also think I want to show the audience how hard some of the things that I do are. If I'd practiced for a couple of years to be able to do a trick and I landed it in front of a crowd with a casual, off-the-cuff manner, it looks cool, sure, but it denies the audience information on the difficulty and sacrifice. And this isn't just about me needing people to know how hard I work. It's about using stagecraft to make sure you let them get the most entertainment out of it. I think people care more about the person on stage if they know the backstory, the context. But that's just my approach, and to be honest, it's one of my approaches. When Fred Astaire dances, and really, is there any better example of someone who made it look easy, we see a man borderline superhuman. Empowered by the music and romance and beautiful tailoring and moonlight, to be able to float across the floor and sometimes up the walls in the most beautiful manner you've ever seen. But Fred had a different goal to me. His was to use his decades of dedication to create something lyrical, beautiful, to conjure the feeling of being in love or being heartbroken or being on top of the world or down at heel with his body over the duration of a song. I think that however counterintuitive it seems, his work is more like a magic show than mine. He's interested in transcending his mortality to weave some magic. His dance routines are him casting a spell. When the music begins and he starts moving, aren't we watching a play about someone who can do anything? With what I do, the end goal is for the audience to have seen me do some cool tricks. Now, do I want them to also leave the venue thinking I was funny and interesting and that my suit also was beautiful? Sure, yes, but the headlines for me are the tricks. I need to make sure they know that they've seen some seriously tricksy stuff. And the best way to do that, at least for the play that I'm the lead character in, is to show them the struggle. The audience have no way of knowing how difficult something is, so I have to carefully, artfully teach them. I just got back from performing for a week in Halifax, Nova Scotia. I had a hell of a time. One of the stages I was booked to perform on was outdoors on the boardwalk by the ocean. It was a gorgeous location. 300 plus people sat on folding chairs in a semicircle around my stage with the blue sky above me, the blue sea behind me. The one singular con to all of those pros was the wind. It gusted unpredictably from the ocean across my stage throughout the show. Mostly, I liked it. It gave me ample opportunity to joke about the chances of a prop getting blown fatally into the face of a child in the front row, before reassuring them with an offhand, "That's a joke, of course, there's no way that would happen twice in one weekend." But once I got to my grand finale, the big trick that I build to throughout the 45 minutes of my act, it became less funny. At the very moment I hit the trick, the wind changed direction hard and caused the climax of my show to fail spectacularly. The audience kind of half cheered since they knew they'd seen something pretty unique and, if we're being honest, in its own way spectacular, but then they went quieter. There was a murmur as they wondered what would happen next. And all I had to do to save the show was say one short sentence. "Shall I try it again?" They cheered, I reset, and I hit the trick a second time and nailed it. And they cheered so much louder because they'd seen me fail. They were in no doubt that this was a real trick. They'd been taught how difficult it was because they'd seen it go wrong. And if they liked me before, they loved me now because I took it on the chin and I gave it another go. For them. This is why circus performers have history of deliberately failing their big trick the first time. Amplify all that good feeling from the audience, get them fully behind you, show them that you love them enough to try it again. I don't think any other art form has this in its culture. You don't find comedians deliberately being unfunny on the first couple of jokes only to be hilarious on the third. Circus feels special that way. In that it tells a story of someone working hard and being brave to do the thing you're there to see. It tells a story of trying. I think that's one of the things I love about it. It lets you tell a human, fragile, often authentic story. Maybe that's something it has in common with sports. The trick is to get people rooting for you rather than just watching you. Anyway, I'm rooting for you, Bill, and I'll talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt, I can't tell you how much I love the notion of creativity being narrative. Margaret Atwood said, "In the end, we'll all become stories." But even before we pass into the realm of story, during our time walking around in the here and now, we are in every creative act spinning a yarn about who we are and what we do. And there are as many ways to do this as there are kinds of creativity and styles of presentation. Style itself is a story. A Stairs was about a man who defied the physical and emotional gravity of the everyday world. I always like to think about Gene Kelly in opposition to A Stair, because he was a performer who nominally did what A Stair did, but he approached it so differently. His story was about muscularity and a regular guy energy that the more elegant and effete A Stair didn't have. It's the classic difference between a dancer and a hoofer. And when they dance together, which they only did once, by the way, in 1945's Ziegfeld Follies, I'm not counting the number they did late in their lives, and that's entertainment. When they dance together in their primes, the tension between their styles, between their stories, lifted the number clean off the screen.
"Well, well, that's life. What do you know? How's a wife? Gotta run. Oh, my. Ta-ta.
Olive oil.
Goodbye."
So maybe the question we ought to be asking is, when we strive to make hard work look easy, what's the story we're trying to tell? About the work? About ourselves? I think it has something to do with the thing we've talked about before. The conception that the most successful creators are the ones who can, in your phrase, dance with the muse. In fact, that's been a continuing motif on this podcast. I don't think it's coincidental that when we were talking about this project, the logline we came up with was a conversation about the hard work of creativity. We deliberately centered the notion of work in one of the first defining moments of this project, because I think we knew even then that dancing with the muse was a trope we were going to have to try to knock down. But that trope is a pesky little bastard. It persists. I think part of the reason why some creators work so hard to make what they do look so easy is that it feeds a narrative that they're natural creators, instinctive creators, that they are, in your words, shiny and golden, and that this sort of effortless creativity is somehow a higher grade of fuel. So let's stick with Astaire and Kelly for a second as we take a deeper look at this. Astaire's on-screen persona was built around the sense that he wasn't held down by the same workaday concerns that constrain normal people, that he was, in some sense, a beautiful alien. That's why, when his character, who was, after all, always really Fred Astaire, when his character was written to be more of a regular guy, it always felt a little wrong, a little off. In Shall We Dance from 1937, he played the premier dancer of a French ballet troupe, the great Petrov, who was, in actuality, plain old tap-dancing Pete Peters from Philadelphia. The trouble was, at least in my eyes, that Peters as Petrov, a broad caricature of a temperamental genius, was more believable than Peters as Peters. No matter how hard the best screenwriters and directors of the era tried, they just couldn't make you believe that Fred Astaire was a 1930s version of Jenny from the Block. Kelly was another matter. Kelly tended to portray feet-on-the-ground kind of guys. Even in Singin' in the Rain, his most famous picture, in which he plays a movie star, he's still a movie star who grew up a hoofer in vaudeville. When we meet him in An American in Paris, he's living in genteel poverty over a cafe and knocking around the left bank with a bunch of neighborhood kids, being charming and silly and thoroughly down to earth. Just an ex-GI who liked the town and decided to stick around. And then there's my favorite of Kelly's MGM musicals. It's Always Fair Weather. This is a very strange movie by the standards of MGM musicals, with a story that is at its heart about the disappointments of the post-war years. It's about three friends, once again ex-GIs, who part at the end of the war with high hopes and grand plans, and reunite 10 years later to find their lives, in various ways, shot to hell. In one key scene, though, Kelly's character manages to reclaim some of his youthful idealism. It's love, of course, that does the trick. And because he happens to be on roller skates, look, it's still an MGM musical, he skates right out onto the streets of New York and dances on roller skates. It's wonderful. It's graceful. It's astounding. And it's such a beautiful illustration of the story that Kelly always told when he danced. A story about the muscle power required for an average guy to do extraordinary things. What's more everyday than roller skates? But on Kelly's feet, they became wings. Astaire and Kelly have always been linked in the imaginations of movie fans, and inevitably compared. But for me, if you stood me up in one of those arguments in a bar about who was the GOAT, Astaire or Kelly, let's say it's a musical comedy bar, just go with me on this, I'd pick Kelly any old day of the week. Because Astaire's story says that some people are individually blessed by the gods to make it look easy, but Kelly's says that anybody can do great things. I know which one I like better, which one is more hopeful, and ultimately, more inspiring. I'll talk to you next time. Bill.
Dear Bill, sometimes when we write this podcast, I guess when we're doing it right, I discover things, I formulate thoughts while we're working on it, rather than just saying what I already think. And this is one of those times, and that feels like a good thing. I mean, if I wasn't one half of a podcast about the hard work of creativity, I'm not sure I would have cause to be thinking quite so much about that hard work. So, as you say, on imagination and junk, from the word go, we made clear that we believe creativity to be genuine work, not some kind of nebulous talent, and don't get me started on how much I dislike that word, but a tangible set of skills, not a gift bestowed, but knowledge learned. But it seems that in this episode we're talking about what you do with that skill, how you present the things you've learned. Does that hard work result in documentary or poetry? Is the thing you make showing its work or pretending it got lucky? The act of considering how you want to frame the artistry you have mastered is part of the artistry. Perhaps deciding how you use your creativity is, in itself, one of the most important parts of the hard work of that creativity. Now, on to the most important part of this episode. I will not be drawn into the argument about who is better, Astaire or Kelly. They're both beautiful geniuses. The way I figure it, they're different enough to not have to be compared. I mean, sure, they're both dance performers who made some of the best musicals in history, but that's just their jobs. As creatives, as artists, they weren't trying to be the best at doing the same thing. They were trying to be beautiful in their uniqueness. Kelly, as you say, the perfect average American ideal guy. Athletic, honest, working class. Astaire, though, so often in his films portraying someone already successful, or at least previously so, and inhabiting a world where, past 6 p.m, why would you not be in evening dress ready for a martini? Kelly, as you say, was a more feet-on-the-ground kind of guy, which even extended to his dance style, grounded, slightly lower, slightly stompier style of tap than Astaire, with a good deal more, and I'm using a professional choreographic term here, ha-cha-cha. Astaire, though, floats around skittering on the floor when he can be bothered to touch it, like a leaf being blown around. This episode is about making it look easy, but even that isn't quite right with Astaire. It's more like his characters never knew it could be hard. Your mention of the roller skating dance reminded me of a story about a street performer that might help with this whole making it look easy versus hard thing. This particular street performer did a roller skating act, and he performed, or at least he did in the late 1980s, in Key West in Florida. The busking pitch there was a boardwalk that ran out into the ocean, a wooden pier, and at the time, at the edges, there was no barrier, just a drop into the sea. He'd gather his audience by slowly rolling backwards across the boardwalk on his skates towards the edge. And he'd roll backwards until the edge was right behind him, and then he'd frantically try to skate forwards, but stay in the exact same spot, right on the edge. Each step with the skates slipping off the pier, continually just on the cusp of calamity. He would also, it should be noted, flap his arms and yell. And then, when he had enough people gawking at him in terror, he'd grin, slide into a pirouette and tell them that now he'd got their attention, the show was about to start. I mean, genius, right? And it feels like he's having his cake and eating it. He's making it look difficult until he reveals how easy he can also make it look. By the way, the whole rolling backwards towards a drop and then skating furiously to hover right on the edge was done before the Key West guy did it. Charlie Chaplin did it in his famous roller skating scene. Astaire conjures dreamlike dance from the feelings of romance. Chaplin does the same, but with chaos. How you present your art is part of your art. When you make something, you're thinking about what you want people to feel when they encounter it. Does it benefit the art for it to look effortless or effortful? Is it magic or circus? Acting or writing? Jazz or classical? Authentic fakery or fake authenticity? I like your assessment of Astaire wanting to come across as if blessed by the gods of dance, but Kelly framing it as something more achievable if the moonlight is just right for anyone. It's tempting to think about what this says about the minds and maybe even egos of either man. It almost reminds me of those YouTube videos of people throwing a water bottle without looking, only for it to bounce off a moving car, a street sign, and a labradoodle before landing perfectly standing up on its end. It looks effortless because they're not showing you the 5 long shoot days of repeating it over and over and over until it just happened to work. But of course that's an empty analogy because Astaire and Kelly both used editing. They both used the good takes, they just used them to tell, and here it is again, a different story. Art is in the choices you make, every single one of them, and with every choice you make, you ever more sharply define what kind of artist you want to be. Like you, I like Kelly's idea that anyone, if they're in love and on roller skates, could do that dance routine. It feels like, for Kelly, an emotion like love is the pep talk from life's coach to get out there and hoof. but for Astaire, love is falling asleep after too much wonderful champagne in fine company and having the most beautiful dream. All right then, I'll cave. In the Kelly versus Astaire argument, here's my answer. Anne Margaret, dancing. I'll talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt, I love the picture of that roller skating busker drifting lazily backwards toward the abyss, and then, like Wile E. Coyote, noticing the risk and wheeling frantically for survival. There's something poetic about it. Besides the fact, of course, that it's a great way to draw a crowd. It reminds me of something Penn Jillette told me when I interviewed him and Teller for Newsweek, around the time of the engagement that made them stars at the old West Side Arts Theater in Manhattan. Apropos of their big trick in which Teller is locked in a giant water tank and apparently drowns while Penn is desperately trying to identify the card picked by an audience member, he told me, "We think it's funny to take something as podunk as a card trick and put death in the background." Do you know the expression podunk over there, by the way? It refers to a hypothetical small town and, by extension, to anything corny or unsophisticated. However, please note that there are some actual places called podunk in the U.S., mostly areas or neighborhoods rather than discrete towns. If I failed to bring that to your attention, then I wouldn't have just now glanced at Wikipedia for 10 seconds. But enough about me and my rigorous research protocol. Let's talk about you. You referred a couple of times to skill and what you do with it, how you package and present the skills you've acquired. But I don't think that's what we're seeing when we compare Astaire and Kelly. I, too, have formulated a new idea in the course of this episode, so let me try it out on you. When it comes to dancers, at least, morphology is destiny. Kelly was, as you say, a low-to-the-ground dancer, because he was a low-to-the-ground guy. He was broad-chested and not that tall, at 5'8". Astaire was taller, by an inch, but he read as even taller than that. He was graceful and light-footed. He floated. He was a creature of the air. Kelly was just a guy. He never looked quite right doing classical dance repertoire, any more than Astaire did when he hoofed. If you ask me, and I'm going to pretend that you did, what accounts for their uncommon grace in two different body types, what allowed them, each in their way, to make it look easy, is that they were in sync, each of them, with those bodies. They were who their bodies made it possible for them to be. So what do we do with this idea? Is there a broader lesson we can take from it? I think there is. We all have basic clay that we work with. Sometimes it's physical, as it is for dancers, or for that matter, jugglers. Sometimes it's emotional, as it is for writers. Sometimes it's technical, as it is for engineers. But the great ones, in every trade, are the ones who figure out how to do the most with the natural clay they've been given. That synchronicity is what we call making it look easy. Does that make sense? I'll talk to you next time. Bill.
Dear Bill, as I was telling you about the street performer with the roller skates, I reminded myself of a story featuring one of my other favorite variety schmucks, W.C. Fields. Before he was a famous comedy star in movies, William Claude Duncan Field was, of course, a very successful juggler. But before he was that, he was just another carny who'd pick up whatever job might get him an inch closer to a stage or an inch further from starvation. When he was in Atlantic City, he struck up a deal with a hot dog seller who worked on the boardwalk. WC had an idea that would benefit them both. He would stroll along the boardwalk and then fall off into the ocean and appear spectacularly and noisily to drown. He'd yell and splutter and flail and splash around until finally managing to save himself from certain death and scramble back up onto dry land right next to the hot dog cart. By this time he'd gathered quite the crowd, of course, and once they realised that the poor chap who came so close to death was going to be all right, they were easy pickings for the hot dog salesman to offer them discount snacks to celebrate. WC got a cut of the profits and ended up nearly dying several times a day. Now that Penn and Teller water tank routine is totally great. Like the roller skating street performer, it's a way of showing how good you are by appearing to be bad. It's like Andy Kaufman's old act, where he'd deliberately bomb for 90% of it, until, right at the end, pulling out a perfect Elvis Presley impersonation and taking the roof off the place. It's a risk, but when it works, it really works. Showing how easy you can make it look, but deliberately making it look hard, it's a hell of a gamble, but it's also an amazing way to leave the audience in no doubt that you know what you're doing. I'm fascinated by your idea that the essence of making it look easy is when your natural self and your artistic presentation are in sync. I'd not thought of it that way, but yeah, I think you could be onto something. And I think what we're talking about there is essentially a kind of emotional maturity. It can take a decent amount of time to know what you are, and I mean really know, both as a maker of creative work and as a person. A lot of people spend so much time obsessing over what they want to be that they miss what they could be, or should be, even. And there's no shame in that. It's allowed to strive towards something like that. But if you're doing it at the expense of self-knowledge, then that's a shame. You can do a bit of both and be the you version of something. You can be, as the brilliant comedian Stuart Lee once said, the him of this. So where does that leave us at the end of this episode about making it look easy? We've strayed, as we often do, but that's okay. Maybe the place we ended up is this. It's interesting and fun and useful to think about how you want to present your work and yourself. To consider if it enhances your work to lead people to believe you could do it in your sleep, or if it'll help people connect with it to show that you're working hard to make it happen. But, as you say, running parallel to this is thinking about which approach suits you best, which seems the most comfortable fit. Talking of fit, if you're long and lean like a stair, then a perfectly cut tailcoat will look amazing on you. If you're a bit more muscular like Gene Kelly, then some wide leg trousers and rolled up shirt sleeves are going to look great. The first thing anyone who knows about tailoring will say is that every cut of clothing doesn't suit every kind of body. Find the cut that suits your shape and then make it your own. If you put in the work to learn how to do that, then I guess to everyone else, you'll be making it look easy. I'll talk to you soon. Matt.
Imagination and Junk is written by Bill Barole in the U.S. and Matt Ricardo in the U.K., with audio production by Bill Barole. For more information, show notes, and bonus content, it's imaginationandjunk.com.